the Anatha itself, and specifically, I mean, this article from The Harmonist. I think we'll go through it in a little more detail. As a matter of interest, how many of you read this article last night? Oh, right, okay, most of you. How many of you found it hard to follow? Most of you, okay. Well, I've read it a few times, quite a number of times, so perhaps I can follow it a little bit, although I was reading it this morning and I could, quite frankly, there are a couple of things I couldn't quite figure out myself, but we'll see what we can do. In fact, a couple of things didn't seem to actually make sense. So, Vatsasura, this is page 21 of our book. Vatsasura came in the form of a calf. There are a number of demons who came and attacked Lord Krishna in the form of animals. And even two of them were in the form of cows, or bovine forms, at least, male or female. So, then there's Keshi, who came in the form of a horse. So Jiva Goswami comments about some of them, and including Vatsasura, that some of the demons who came to attack Krishna, some of them, of course, being big, tough demons, they, of course, they were foolish, but still, in their demoniac way, they were thinking, oh, Krishna's just a little boy. Just a little boy. And I'm a big, powerful demon. So what's this little boy going to be able to do against me? So, in the majority of cases, most of these demons were feeling very confident and very, like a very arrogant sense of pride in their own strength. So they just came and attacked Krishna without thinking about it even. In fact, they were thinking that it was going to be just easy, no problem at all, but of course they found out differently. But in the case of a few of them, they weren't feeling so confident. And Vatsasura is one of them. Vatsasura was told by Kamsa that you go and kill this little boy Krishna. And Vatsasura was thinking, wait a minute, this so-called little boy Krishna just killed Putana, Trinavata, Shakatasura, and there were other demons also who are not referred to in the Bhagavatam. So this so-called little boy Krishna doesn't seem to just be like your ordinary little boy that someone like me could just go and kill very easily. So Vatsasura was not feeling confident. And Jiva Goswami explains that therefore he transformed himself into the form of a calf, knowing that Krishna is Gopal, the protector of the cows and the calves. So he was thinking, he was hoping, that if I get defeated, maybe Krishna will be a little merciful and not kill me, because I'm in the form of a calf. So Vatsasura was thinking like this. In his previous life, according to Garga Samhita, he was a demon named Pramila, son of Muru. Muru is a big demon. And Pramila conquered the demigods in battle and went into Vashishta's ashram, the great universal sage Vashishta, and he saw the beautiful Nandini cow. So Pramila decided he wanted that cow, but he thought that, first of all, he thought, I don't want to just kill Vashishta and take the cow because there'd probably be some very bad reaction. Then he thought that if I just go up to him and ask him, then he'll see that here's a demon asking me for my cow. So it's very unlikely he'll give me the cow. So then he thought, yes, let me disguise myself as a Brahmin. And then maybe Vashishta will feel a little bit more ready to give me the cow. So he transformed himself, or disguised himself, as a Brahmin and came in and made his request. But both Vashishta and the cow They both realized that this is a demon disguising himself. So, then actually the cow cursed him. That you like to assume, you're very attached to cows, and you like to assume some other form, so you take the form of a cow or a calf. So then Pramila was forced to take that form, but then Vashishta told him that, don't worry, in a while you'll be liberated by the hand of the Lord. I think some of you haven't marked yourselves present, am I right? Yes, so just pass it back, thanks. And this other piece of paper here, for those of you who came in a little late, is anyone who wants copies of my notes, my personal notes for this course. It's 75 paise a sheet, and there's probably something like 100 sheets. So if you write your name down, then you can get a copy in a couple of days. And should it be passed around again? Are there some others? Oh, okay. From the description given, there are different descriptions, of course, of this pastime, as in the case of virtually all of the main pastimes of Krishna. Here he's cursed to be a calf, but it appears also that sometimes in his next birth as Vatsasura, sometimes he was also in a human form. And that applies also with some of the other demons. They appear to fluctuate between some animal form and a human form, somehow or other. Exactly how it works, I don't really know, but it appears to be like that. And it appears to be like that with Vatsasura, because Jiva Goswami says that he assumed the form of a calf with that particular idea in mind, feeling afraid of Krishna and thinking that Krishna would be compassionate to him if he was in the form of a calf. So, this particular pastime takes place when Krishna was three. Krishna had just fairly recently turned three. Anyone still not marked themselves present? Pass it back to the men at the back, thanks. Krishna was three. When Krishna turns three, we find in Srimad Bhagavatam there's a transition that, having had Vatsalya Rasa as the prominent relationship, that now, when Krishna turns three, in other words, at the time of this particular pastime, now there's a transition and Sakya Rasa becomes more prominent. He starts herding the calves and then the cows. So, there are very nice descriptions in the Bhagavatam of how Krishna was growing up as a one-year-old, two-year-old, and then finally approaching three-year-old child. The elderly gopis would play with Krishna, as parents do, or as adults do with children. They would make little, almost like little wages or special little offers to him, that Krishna, I'll give you this sweetmeat if you'll dance for me. So then little baby Krishna, hardly able to stand up, would then do a little dance and fall over. So we all know what children are like, and you know, there's a certain and a very strong fascination with such little pastimes with children. So you can just imagine, actually we can't really imagine, but we can try to imagine a little, what it must have been like with Krishna. Must have really been quite something. Krishna playing with the elderly gopis in his childish way. But of course Krishna's fully conscious and fully intelligent, so he knows how to play with them in such a way to really evoke their affectionate sentiments. It's described, he became like a wooden doll in their hands, that they would just apparently manipulate him to do all sorts of childish little playful things, and then they would enjoy. like that. Enjoy him watching. And as he became able to walk and a little able to do things, then Mother Yashoda would engage him in helping a little bit around the house, just a little bit. Sometimes she would tell him that you go and get such and such a thing. There's a nice description. Actually, there's a picture done by one of our artists that appeared on the cover of Back to Godhead years ago. Krishna carrying Nanda Maharaj's shoes on his head and delivering them to Nanda Maharaj, little baby Krishna. So Krishna would do things like that. And Mother Yashoda would engage him like that. Tell him, you please go and fetch this, or you please go and do that. And so Krishna would try. There's a nice description. Nanda Maharaj is coming home, just entering the house. Krishna sees him. So Krishna runs off to get his cushion. Nanda Maharaj has a special big cushion. So little baby Krishna goes toddling off, grabs the cushion and tries to pull it. But it's very heavy and he's very small. So little Krishna's pulling and he falls on the ground. And then he gets up and pulls it again and falls on the ground. And some adult sees, oh, here's a little baby Krishna trying to do something for his father, very nice, but he can't really do it, so let me help. So the adult intervenes and says, don't worry, I'll do it, and takes hold of the cushion, but Krishna then slaps them on the arm. No, no, I want to do it. So Krishna, feeling great affection for his dear devotees, and it's expressed in the Bhagavatam that Krishna, speaking in half-broken language, just like a child, he would go through all these different types of exchanges with the adults in parental rasa in those first 2 or 3 years. Then, after some time, the inhabitants of Vrindavan moved. They moved from Gokul, which is in the south more, just south or southeast or so of Mathura, just on the other side of the Yamuna and further down. So they moved from there up to Vrindavan. They ended up here eventually. There were one or two stops on the way. But they ended up here in Vrindavan. So this Vatsasura pastime takes place in Vrindavan, or when at least Krishna's living in this particular area here. So Krishna, when he turned 3, he decided he wanted to herd the calves, not the cows. When Krishna turns 6, he starts herding the cows. But when he turns 3, he wants to herd the calves, just the little small animals. So Nanda Maharaj thought, this is okay, this is all right. Mother Yashoda, though, she didn't think it was a very good idea. Of course, she had had Krishna there with her 24 hours a day up till this point. So her main idea in thinking that, no, Krishna shouldn't have to go out and herd the calves, the basic idea was that she didn't want to have to go through that separation of not having Krishna with her during the course of the day. Just like some mothers, when their children have their first day in school, the children often cry, being separated from their mother for the first time in so many years. But some mothers also cry. My mother told me she cried when I went to my first day at school, and I cried. I can still remember. 5 years old. Anyway. So just imagine if your child is Krishna and you've been with him 24 hours a day and going through all these pastimes moment by moment every day, in this case for 3 years, and then the idea comes up, separation for several hours a day. So it was certainly rather shocking thought to Mother Yashoda. So the descriptions given by Jiva Goswami, actually, that Mother Yashoda protested, but when she saw that Nanda Maharaj, he was actually into the idea, because he was already, in a sense, used to having some separation from Krishna, in one sense, because he would go out every day into the fields, and then he would come back later. So in one regard, it wasn't such a big thing for him to deal with. So he was a little firm, and Mother Yashoda agreed. She's a very obedient wife. In fact, it's described when Akrura came and asked that you please let me take Krishna to Mathura, because Kamsa once wanted him. Then everyone was completely devastated with the idea. But Nanda Maharaj became convinced. So he told Mother Yashoda. Mother Yashoda had been hiding Krishna, saying he wasn't there, and trying all sorts of things. But then Nanda Maharaj said, all right, we should let him go, because he'll be back in a day. Famous last words or something like that. So immediately Mother Yashoda agreed. She agreed. I forget her exact words. Anyway, she said something like, I know no authority but you, to Nanda Maharaj, something like that. So very obediently she agreed. But then the next thing she said was, I'm going to. I'm coming. But Krishna, or I think Balaram actually then spoke up and said, but Mata, who's going to look after the house? And she said, Rohini will. And then Balaram said, actually, you know, we're not really going to herd the calves. We're just going to play. That's all we're going to do. So you wouldn't really fit in. Anyway, in the end, she agreed that she would stay back. So there was a ceremony. Jiva Goswami describes the ceremony. It was something like a samskar even, like a... There were Brahmins taking part in it. There's a ceremony. Different people gave Krishna different things in preparation for his first day out herding the calves. Someone gave him a little stick, a little red stick for herding the cows, calves. Someone gave him a rope. Someone gave him a buffalo horn. Someone gave him a flute. I don't know if that was his first flute. Probably not. But anyway, someone gave him a flute. Then Mother Yashoda went running out and came back a little later with some beautiful shoes. Beautiful. Very, very wonderful little shoes for Krishna. And a beautiful umbrella. And she told Krishna, here, you take these things. You wear the shoes on your feet because they're prickles and stones and things. So we don't want you to hurt your feet. And then she said, I'm going to send one servant with you and he'll carry the umbrella over your head. And you know what Krishna said? It's very interesting. Krishna said, no, I'm not taking them. Actually, I will take them, but I want you to make 4 shoes for each calf. And an umbrella for each calf. And I want one servant for each calf to hold the umbrella. Then I'll wear these shoes, and then I'll accept the servant with the umbrella. Otherwise, no. And then Krishna spoke one very well-known, it's like a sutra or aphorism, brief statement, Dharamo Rakshati Rakshataha, which means that he who protects religion is protected by the same religion. He who protects Dharma is in turn protected by Dharma. And he said, these cows and calves, they are our Dharma. And if we protect them, then in turn we'll be protected by that. So he said, I won't accept anything better than what the cows have, or the calves in this case. So if we talk about cow protection, Krishna is the original Gopal. Go means cows, of course, and Pala means protector. Krishna is the original, like, authority or acharya in the system of protecting cows and calves. So what's his standard of protecting? That we don't take better facilities than what they have. And that's real cow protection. Pretty advanced idea. But that's coming directly from Krishna. Dharma rakshati rakshataha. He who protects Dharma becomes protected by that Dharma. So therefore Krishna refused. I won't take anything better than what the calves have. So then the next day, the first day, Nanda Maharaj and Mother Yashoda came. Krishna couldn't turn them away. Eventually he turned them away. And they were giving all sorts of advice, as parents do. Telling him, don't do this, don't do that, and making all sorts of arrangements so he'd be protected. But as soon as they sent them away, and of course when the parents were there, when the older people were there, then Krishna and Balaram and the cowherd boys, they were acting very nicely, like very good boys. As soon as they, somehow Krishna managed to convince his parents to go back, as soon as they went back, then, not exactly that all hell broke loose, but boys will be boys, as they say. So the boys started to be really like boys. And playing and wrestling and throwing balls around and playing football with fruits. Disguising themselves as animals, chasing animals, imitating animals, doing all sorts of things. You've probably read the descriptions. So, a whole different mood from the mood of that was there in the exchanges in Vatsalya Ras. So this is like the first real manifestation of very like a great focus on Sakya Ras. So out they went. Then Vatsasura came, disguised as a calf. And he snuck into the herd, even though there were so many calves. Tomorrow we'll be talking about Bakasura, so we'll explain how many calves. But there was a lot of calves, many millions of calves. And this demon snuck in the form of a calf, but Krishna was aware. This is a demon. So he made some sign to Balaram without saying anything. Then he just nonchalantly walked over to that calf and grabbed it by the rear legs, spun it around and around, and threw it up onto the top of a, what's the tree called? Some kapita tree. With such an impact that the tree fell down. And according to the Bhagavatam, Krishna had a dual purpose in doing this. One was to kill the demon. The other was so they could enjoy the kapita fruits. So with the tree knocked to the ground, they were able to get all the fruits and enjoy them. So in this way, it was very nice. All the cowherd boys were applauding, demigods were showering flowers. And the boys were wondering, what, where are all these flowers coming from? But then after a few minutes, they just forgot and just again became absorbed in their pastimes with Krishna and Balaram. So, Vatsasura represents, it's really like Maya for children. That's the basic idea with Vatsasura. It can also represent in adults a tendency to be like foolishly innocent, too naive. Srila Prabhupada, he sometimes would exhibit an apparent innocence, or a real innocence actually. And when he did like that, then sometimes devotees would wonder, you know, if he thinks like this, so innocently, then how come he's so deep also? I mean, so inconceivably deep. But that's the nature of an elevated soul like Srila Prabhupada, that his innocence doesn't mean that he's a fool. Actually, he was extremely intelligent, to say the least. Has everyone who wants a set of notes written their name down? I hope so. Okay. And the attendance sheet someone has? It's there. Okay. All right. So now what we'll do, for maybe 15 minutes or so, we'll read through this article from The Harmonist. It's very interesting. Like in the case of Putana, it's very, you might say, aggressive or at least very strong preaching, and particularly focusing on the subject of the training of children in Krishna consciousness. It might even be a bit too strong for some of us, at least some who are parents and may have some ideas which perhaps are a little different to what are being expressed here. But let's go through it. And I think we can all appreciate that in principle, the points being made, that they're very valid, even though we may have had trouble applying them all in Krishna consciousness over the last so many years, in some cases at least. So, Vatsasura, this is bottom of page 21, particularly represents evils that are peculiar to boyhood, or we could say childhood. When this was written, the general idea was that boys were educated, boys went to school, and girls didn't really go to school so much, which is really like the traditional Vedic concept. Of course, times have changed. So, you know, perhaps we could substitute the word childhood here. I mean, at least, yeah, I think that would be reasonable. And also neophytes. Some neophytes, maybe. Neophytes in Krishna consciousness, to some extent, these things may apply. And this can only be removed by the grace of Krishna. All these anathas, which the demons who were killed by Krishna represent, the general idea is, of course, naturally that we make an effort to overcome them, but ultimately it is up to Krishna to remove the anatha, or as in the case of the demons, to kill the demon. So if we surrender to Krishna and really try, then Krishna will reciprocate by killing the demon or killing the anatha. So, there's an English proverb that sowing of wild oats is inevitable at a young age. In other words, children may be a little wild, something like that. Then he goes into explaining about the term Puritanism. Puritanism was a phenomenon, I think, more of Victorian days in England particularly. It's like artificial morality, even excessive morality. Trying to be very, very morally upright, but with no real foundation other than just some sort of idea that it would be better to be like that. But not like in Krishna consciousness, where there's the foundation of the relationship with Krishna upon which one can follow regulative principles and not do things which other people, which materialistic people would do, immoral things. So, in this first point then, which goes over to the top of page 22, the basic idea is that boys will be boys and girls will be girls. I'm sure. they have to be. So children will be children, and that's life. And you can't really, I mean, you've got to train them. You can't just let them go wild. But you can't repress them and just straitjacket them. You have to let them, like here we have those of us who are staying in these rooms just immediately across here, every afternoon we have the Wembley Cup final. Oh, they tried to start during lunchtime yesterday. The ball came rolling over into our prasadam taking area. So it's really, I mean, it's quite... Second point, he says that that this doesn't mean that there should be no training, because they can get diverted if they get some bad association. There are indeed black sheep, and these shouldn't be allowed to taint the whole flock. So therefore you need good caretakers, you know, really like proper teachers, and proper training has to be there, so that they can let their energy out, but still training can be there, so things develop healthily and in a spiritually progressive way also. And the way, the basic mode of that training, he's saying in point two, is not just to restrict them, but to give them Krishna. If you give the children Krishna, then just like we see here, at least it seems to me, not that I know much about education, but little children, little boys seem to be doing very nicely on the whole and becoming Krishna conscious in their own childish ways. But it's very, very nice. And in this way, they're becoming good devotees and upholding good standards of conduct generally. So the only way to really help children to develop nicely is to give them Krishna consciousness, not just tell them you can't do this and you can't do that. So then point three is a rather interesting point. He's saying in point three that the puritanic idea, or the idea of the mundane moralists, is don't let the children do immoral things while they're children, because they should do those things when they're older. And if they do them when they're children, then when it comes to the time that they're older, they won't be able to get into those things so much. So their pleasure will be less, if you follow the idea. Just like in most countries, it's illegal for children to drink liquor or vote. Both are probably dangerous. Or smoke cigarettes. Generally, these things are illegal. Or sexual activity also. These things are illegal. So this is this mundane idea of morality upheld in virtually all civilized cultures, so-called civilized cultures. But what he's saying here in point three is that their idea is not that we're telling these children that these things are really wrong, but the point is that when it comes time for their adulthood, which is when people generally sort of do things in their lives more substantially, then they won't be able to enjoy these activities as adults if they already got into them when they were children, because they will have sort of deteriorated themselves so much by doing those things as children that when they become adults, they won't be able to do those things so well. You follow the idea? Yeah, it's a very interesting idea. Unless the young person husbands his resources of sense gratification, he'll be a victim of premature old age. It's a policy of expediency, of postponing a small amount of pleasure now in order to get more pleasure later. Shreyas and prayas. Take your pleasure now, but it's a smaller pleasure. Or take your pleasure later, and it'll be a greater pleasure. That's the idea. In fact, so their idea is not to be moral. They don't want to be moral. As far as they're concerned, our business in life is to be immoral and smoke and drink and have sex and do all these things. These are the sources of happiness in life. But they impose morality on children, the idea being that they can enjoy the immorality more when they're adults. Then in point four, which is quite long, it's discussing like the Indian version, what he calls the spurious Brahmacharya ideal. that in those days, not so much now, in those days and particularly previously, boys were sent to a gurukul to become brahmacharis, and that was the system of education. And it involved being trained in morality, but not Krishna consciousness, generally. A mundane type of brahmacharya. So he says that, if you turn over to the top of page 23, that these practices of asceticism, renunciation, they're actually being thought of in an Epicurean spirit. Epicurean means a spirit of sense gratification. The renunciate dreams of mastering nature, controlling his senses, so then material nature won't be able to dictate to him. So he can then master nature, and then he can use material nature for his own benefit, without getting controlled by that material nature. This is the idea. Through practicing this brahmacharya in childhood, not Krishna conscious, like this mundane morality concept of brahmacharya, then they get mastery over their own bodies and minds and material nature. Then they can really exploit material nature. And still in the first paragraph at the top of page 23, this type of brahmacharya, according to this ascetic point of view, goes through a period of training in severe abstinence, or, you know, being severely restricted in what sense gratification he gets. The whole idea is that when he becomes older, he can become a good citizen and create a very nice, mundane society where everyone can gratify their senses very nicely, in a very sort of upstanding way, but not be Krishna conscious. There's no reference to the service of God or to any spiritual issue. Then he makes an interesting point in the next paragraph that morality isn't spiritual. Morality will not produce spirituality. In other words, we follow our four regulative principles, but not just so we become teetotalers and non-smokers and celibates and non-gamblers. No. But those principles are there just to serve the main principle, which is to always remember Krishna and never forget him, which you can't really do if you're smoking and drinking and doing all those things. So those negative prohibitions are just servants of that one principle, to become Krishna conscious. But it's not that those principles will produce Krishna consciousness in you at all. If you refrain from smoking, that won't make you devotional. Someone hands you a cigarette and you say in a very devotional way, "No thanks," something like that. It won't make you spiritual. It won't make you devotional. So, in the last sentence of the second paragraph on page 23, he says, if brahmacharya means a method of gaining moral power, it's simply a mundane affair. And it's of no concern to the soul, but is actually obstructive to spiritual well-being. This is like we mentioned on the second day of our course, piety being an anatha. Piety can be an anatha. So in this context, it can be an anatha. And then he goes on to say that you can only really be moral if you're Krishna conscious. Just like vegetarianism. People take vegetarianism to be an expression of morality, generally. Not to hurt the animals and maintain better health for the body and nicer sort of condition of existence, which is very nice. It's very nice for the animals that they don't get killed so much, but it's not very nice for the vegetables. The vegetables find that war has been declared on them, and they're now being killed in far greater numbers. So to be vegetarian is not exactly purely moral or morally pure. No. It's not morally pure. Or to give charity to the poor people. If you give charity to the poor people who can't afford a meal, then that's morally very nice on one level, materially. But what generally happens to those people if they get enough charity and then they get a nice house and now they're not poor? What do? They eat meat, because now they can afford meat. They can afford cigarettes. They can afford liquor. So generally it will mean that they expand their sense gratification. Not that we're advocating just keep people in abject poverty. But generally, when you uplift people from poverty, one part of the result is that you increase their sinful life. So on one level it appears moral. On another level, it's not actually moral. Very interesting way of looking at it. Let's see. Oh, then point five, going over to page 24. This is a real bit of a cutting one. The point is that, at least in the ideal situation, where ideal teachers, or at least like nicely qualified teachers, are really available, he's making the point that it is better for children to be trained by people other than their parents. At least where there are proper teachers who can really do a very nice job, where they're available, then generally this is better actually. And I'm not a parent, and so, you know, I can't speak so authoritatively from experience, but I could say that many Gurukul teachers have told me things along those lines, and even many parents have told me things like that. Of course, you know, those of you who have parents would know that we've had quite significant difficulties in our Gurukul system, and many parents have more or less been forced to take up the education of their children. And in many cases, they've done quite a good job of it. But ideally speaking, the point here, in principle, is that if properly qualified teachers are there, then generally it is better that they do it. Because of the family bodily relationship, it can be difficult to really educate and help a child to develop in the best way if one has that intimate relationship as a parent. And on top of that, he says, the last sentence in point five, the training is not for the children only, but it's a training for the parents as well. Poor old parents tend to get materially attached sometimes. So it can also be a type of training in that sense. To become a little detached from their children, at least if they can be confident that the children are in very good hands, getting a very nice education in Krishna consciousness. Then in point six, he makes the point that children, we've said that you should let children be children, you shouldn't place too many constraints on them, but at the same time we should recognize that they really need training. And their own tendencies to get into Maya in their own childish ways are as dangerous for them, for their Krishna consciousness, as an adult's tendencies to get into Maya in an adult way. So just the fact that they're little, innocent little smiling children shouldn't mislead us to think that they don't need to be carefully and very methodically trained at length over a period of some years. So, let's see if there are any comments or questions. Any comments or questions from anyone?
First 3 days were all in Gokul.
Yeah, they're all in Gokul, right.
Were there any demons in between Gokul and
Well, no. No, there's not that. All of them, including Nalakuva and Manigriva, they're all in Gokul. In fact, you find their places there. The place where Putana was killed is there. The place where Krishna knocked over the Arjun trees is also there. All these places are there in Gokul. Then they came and they came to Chatikar, apparently, which is where this Bhaktivedanta Swami Marg meets the main Delhi Agra, Delhi Mathura Road. So apparently they stayed there for a while, then then came here, and then later went to Nandagram. So this Vatsasura, the time they spent in Chatikar is not, doesn't seem to be differentiated from the time they spent in Vrindavan. So this particular pastime seems to take place when they're in the Vrindavan area somewhere. It may be out at Chatikar, it may be around here, but somewhere around this vicinity. But there are no demons in between, in the Bhagavatam. Yeah, when Krishna, I forget the exact date, it's in the our 10th canto Srimad Bhagavatam, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur gives an exact calculation to the month. 6 years and about 3 or 4 or 5 months or something. Yeah. In Gokul for about 3 years, he gives the exact 3 years and so many months. And then in this area from that point to 6 years and however many months. And then Nandagram up to the point of, well, it's, again, I forget, but 10 years, around 11 years. But by that time, Krishna had aged to the point of 16, although he'd only been present for 10 or 11 years. So sometimes it's said that he left Vrindavan when he was 16, and other times when he was 11. But this is the idea which applies. Some other comments or questions? What did you?
When Krishna was young, you said he was speaking in broken language.
Right.
Is this broken Sanskrit or bridge bus?
Broken bridge bus, village language. They still speak some sort of version of it here. If you, anyone who understands Hindi, if you listen, of course I don't, I can just understand it very little bit. You hear them. And you can tell that this is not really Hindi. What to speak of Sanskrit? There's only one form of the word which means you. In Hindi there's tum and aap. But in Brijbhas it's all tum, which is a little disrespectful, particularly for older people. So yeah, it's a village language. So we understand that in one sense Sanskrit is not the highest language, but this bridge bus language is really the highest language. Of course nowadays we couldn't say that it's exactly the same. You find in Rupa Goswami's dramas that he has his actors speaking sometimes in Sanskrit and sometimes in what he calls Prakrit, which is like this kitchen Sanskrit, something like that. Yeah, Sanskrit's used in Vaikuntha. That's really like the home of Sanskrit. It's a very formal language, but this bridge bus language is a very informal language, like everything in Krishna's pastimes. It's very informal. Yeah, like that. Any other comments or questions? So read over Bakasura. It's an interesting pastime. We have some interesting information about this pastime. I'm sure you'll find it quite stimulating. About the battle with Bakasura. Yes?
You asked us to take 5 points.
Right. Yeah, maybe I could just make that a little clearer. That on pages 18 and 19, Narada Muni presents a whole line of reasoning. First of all, he's analyzing the position of Nalakuva and Manigriva, and then he says what he feels would be best to help them, considering their position. So we want you to learn any five. So now you might wonder, well, what is one point? What is one point? So, like we mentioned about Narada thinks within his mind, who does the body belong to? Then he suggests, maybe it belongs to the person who feeds the body. So that's one point. Then he suggests, maybe it belongs to oneself personally. So that's the second point. Or maybe it belongs to your employer. That's the third point. Then maybe it belongs, if you become a slave, maybe it belongs to you, the slave master. And then maybe it belongs to the father. Maybe it belongs to the mother. So these are all, each one is a different point. You follow? Not just that the question of who does the body belong to is one point, necessarily. Otherwise you might find it difficult to find five points. So we're talking in quite detailed terms. You could just list out these different points and you get 5 points. Or his arguments about the benefits of poverty to a person who's very materially attached, how poverty will help them. So there's a number of points under the general heading of poverty. There's a number of points. Like, if you're poor, then you feel pain, and then you feel for other people's pain. So that's one point. Then if you're poor, you're forced to perform austerity, which you benefit for, just like another person who voluntarily accepts austerity. So that's another point. You follow? I hope it's clear enough to everyone. Okay.
Mm-hmm. So you want us to learn 5 points in each of those two categories?
No.
One.
Any five points that Narada Muni makes on pages 18 and 19. Yeah. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.